Hello and welcome everybody to the latest episode of Collectively Speaking. This is a podcast series where we look at the big issues in the built environment. It's a series where we interview members but also collaborators with the LDN Collective. And we're very grateful to be here at DAR Group's offices in Chancery Lane, recording a few different sessions here today. And this session is with somebody who I hold in the highest regard and really have enjoyed working with immensely over the last few years. And that's Mike Saunders, who's the founder of Commonplace. And Commonplace is quite a unique thing because it's a product, it's a service, but it's really about driving a sort of a movement to make the built environment and urban planning something that considers more the people that it affects and how to actually have those conversations right from the very beginning and keep those conversations going too. And I can always say to people that you can tell the difference between a project that has used Commonplace and a project that hasn't, because the outcomes are very different. Absolutely delighted to be here today with Mike Saunders, who's the chief exec of Commonplace. Many people would have heard of, some may not have, as it's an area that is increasingly seen as critical in the built environment, which is the ability to engage with as many people as possible about the shape and form and future of the places where they live and work and play. And Commonplace were, and Mike himself was one of our founding members of the LDN Collective. And we've worked on some really interesting things together over the last few years and other great things happening in the pipeline. But I remember there was one train journey, Mike, that we spent together where you told me a bit about your background. And I just found that fascinating because I think in some ways it resonated with me because it hasn't been the typical journey in terms of how you first got into thinking about the built environment and what you studied. So tell us a bit more about that and the squiggly lines, as it were.
The squiggly lines, okay. Well, first of all, really, really delighted to be a member of the London Collective. It's been a fantastic opportunity for me and for us as a company. Yeah, I quite like to describe my career as a smorgasbord because it doesn't follow any particular pattern from the outside. And I guess, I don't know, where do I start? You know, I grew up in a community, in quite a strong community locally. My parents were really interested in community. And so a lot of what we did was based around, you know, people who live locally, around kind of supporting various different things that were going on. And I guess I felt that was a really positive thing. You know, it was part of my childhood. A strong sense of community. Yeah, you can probably hear my broad Sheffield accent.
I can now you mention it.
I was really interested in architecture at school. I was really interested in the possibility of being an architect at school. But back in the 80s, certainly in the school that I went to, which was a very good school, but it was quite kind of, you were either a scientist or you were doing the arts, and architecture kind of fell somewhere in the middle. And so I was persuaded not to think about that as a career option. But I was always kind of fascinated, I think, by, you know, how people live, how they connect, the role of their neighborhood and the design process as well. But I ended up studying physics and philosophy. I'm a Libra, and so needed a bit of balance. And went on to work in a bank. So I kind of took the first job really that was offered to me, and was trained as a software engineer for a couple of years, which was a fantastic grounding. But I decided fairly quickly that I didn't want to work in finance, and left that to do an MA in interactive design, what was called interactive design, which was really early days of the internet, sort of working out how this Wild West was going to develop and, you know, what you can do with it as a medium and how people communicate on it and all that sort of stuff, which was totally fascinating and, you know, really blew my mind back then because it was something that I'd never really encountered before, this idea of a network that extended globally and, you know, could was chaotic and could allow people to communicate peer to peer and all these brilliant things. Finished the MA and then, again, weirdly and without any sort of pre-thought on my part, became an entrepreneur and started my own business, which was a web agency, which we ran for about 8 years and grew gradually and eventually sold. And we kind of focused on what ended up being, I guess, crowdsourcing, using the internet as a way of getting lots of people to interact together in different ways. A lot of it was around education. So we did, you know, what would be called now something like citizen science, lots of work with schools. And once I'd sold that company, I decided this was something I really wanted to try and find a way of pursuing, which I then did through some work in broadcast, through working a bit in government, through working for some other software companies, and then finally landed up in a really interesting role with a scientific and education institution, where I was doing lots of the citizen science stuff. But I was also responsible for some of the communications things. And at a point about 3.5 years into that job, I think, I was asked if I would take care of this urban, what was essentially an urban design project, because it required this organization, which was also a landowner, to interact with the community about a scheme that they were thinking of building, which wasn't a particularly big or complicated scheme at all. So I was thrown into this world which I'd never encountered, never had really any experience of, and was forced to try very quickly to learn the language, to understand the process, to try and work out what on earth I was going to do to make this project work, and ended up really, really messing it up quite badly.
like all great businesses, experiments that often go wrong.
Indeed. And it was quite painful for me personally, and it was, you know, it caused some problems for the organization as well. And it came to me kind of during that process or soon after that there was something really interesting in that mistake, which was that if I'd had some sort of information, better understanding, better way of knowing the community that I was trying to interact with, I would have had at least a kind of good chance of making a better stab at it, and perhaps it being a bit less painful and a bit less chaotic.
Well, that's really interesting, and that's in how Commonplace was born, was out
it's
of that.
It's kind of how the idea was born,
yeah,
in the first place. I mean, it took several years after that for it to become anything that was recognisable.
But you recognise the need at that point, and then that's what started you on the journey towards creating a platform that can be relied upon.
Yeah, I recognised the need, and I was absolutely no expert at all. I'd had one kind of experience, so I then spent quite a lot of time starting to talk to people, starting to understand whether there was a broader need. I was really lucky to have the opportunity to do a TEDx talk in 2012, I think it was, when I pitched, I guess, this idea that was related to how kind of social media and cities interacted and what I thought the opportunity was for social media to play a slightly different role. And that eventually turned into a discussion with various people who heard it or been told about it.
Right. Well, I haven't seen that, Michael. I have to go and watch it.
I can tell you one thing.
Yeah.
I look a lot younger.
I'm sure I did too. But that was interesting because that was around the time that we published the Farrell Review 10 or 11 years ago, when we started it 11 years ago. And I remember one of our main conclusions and recommendations was that we need to be engaging with people in different ways and using technology to help do that. But at the time, there weren't any really established sort of platforms or organizations that you could work with to do that. But so it's something that really has transformed in the last 10 years in the sense that it's now seen as something that is not nice to have. It's becoming more of an essential tool for urban planning, urban design, architecture at different scales. And so I think it's quite an interesting time to be talking to you about this, because obviously there's a lot's happened in the last 10 years, but as I'm sure you'll agree, there's still quite a long way to go. And I don't know whether you know, but before I got into architecture and worked for Farrells, which was, you know, 11, 12 years ago, I worked for Electoral Reform Services. Yeah, and one of the projects I worked on, and it's just reminded me when you were talking then, one of the projects that I was asked to sort of take a lead role on in terms of the management, not the sort of programming side, because I don't do that, but was the shift from physical voting with ballot papers to online voting. And it sounds like quite a straightforward, simple thing, but it was hugely complicated, not least because of the issues around trust. And it was particularly when it's something like a vote and your own, being part of a democratic process, you know, the technical side wasn't the hard bit. It was actually people's emotions around it and the desire to stick to having a piece of paper that you can do a cross on over a four-digit code, which you know, was at the time it was very challenging, but obviously now it's very commonplace. Excuse the pun. But there's still those issues, isn't there, around trust and around whether or not they believe that taking part in these types of things will change anything as well. You know, how do you sort of make sure that you're tackling the human emotional side at the same time as the sort of technical side of what you do?
Wow. I think the answer is that the human emotion side, and particularly this issue around trust, has to come first in every instance. And you know, sometimes that means that digital isn't the right tool on its own. And in fact, it always means that it's not the right tool on its own. Every single project, I think, that Common Place has been involved in, bar maybe one or two, has had a whole mix of different approaches and different tools that have been used to engage people. And understanding who is potentially going to take part, what their kind of their thoughts and sometimes their kind of baggage is relating to it, you know, because in many cases the projects have had a previous set of kind of phases or interactions, so you have to you're not always starting from a blank sheet of paper, as it were, with the community. So you're often having to come in and work out what's happened and where the community is. It's a very, very complex situation. Every situation, every project's different.
But you more often than not, you do find that people that wouldn't have otherwise got involved do, because they have the ability to go online, use their phone or their laptop, and you know they might not have the time to turn up at a town hall on a Wednesday afternoon, which you know not everyone does.
That's right. Yeah, I mean digital provides a completely different way of interacting that can be extremely time efficient. It can feel completely different. I mean, you know, doing something on your phone when you're sitting on the settee or when you're on the bus on the way to work is a completely different experience from showing up to a town hall meeting. And in some ways it's not as good, and in other ways it's much better. But it can have the effect of lowering the barriers significantly, and particularly for certain types of people. So, you know, for people who are time poor, particularly younger people sometimes who don't see it as their kind of environment to go along to these meetings, or maybe feel a bit anxious about going along to those kind of meetings, but are really bought into where they live and really want to have an influence in what's going on.
And it's the younger generation that are most affected by things like the housing crisis and the climate crisis. So in many ways, they're the people we need to be reaching out to if we're going to sort of help address those big issues.
Yeah, they're the future custodians of every place. And you know, one of the things that I'm really interested in with Common Place is the idea that the problems and challenges that face places and their communities have to be, I think, dealt with from the bottom up as well as the top down. You can't just do the bottom up, but I think if you're missing the bottom up, it's really difficult to make a meaningful change happen that actually benefits the majority of people who are living in a place.
Interesting. And one of the most sort of memorable and most enjoyable projects I've worked on since we set up the LDN Collective was Park Power, and that came about initially from a conversation between the two of us around how do you engage people more broadly about their built environment, the places that they live or work, that isn't necessarily linked to a particular site or a particular planning application. And actually, that was one of the things that came out of the Farrell Review when we did it 10 years ago, was this idea of having, rather than having design reviews of a project and a scheme, is what we then call place reviews, where you're having much broader conversations with what might be missing from a place or what parts of the public realm might really affect people's daily lives that don't often get talked about, you know? And we focused on parks and green spaces, and that was just a really interesting sort of journey, because you know, we had to create a map of London essentially that people could then drop a pin on, talk about their own park or where they might want to have a park, where in the more post-industrial areas, and then answer questions about all sorts of different aspects of planning and designing green spaces. And you know, we managed to get, I think it was 3,500 people to take part in a space for a month, not least because we did a lot on social media, which I found fascinating, because it was actually one of those sort of targeted social media which was for social good rather than trying to influence people to vote in a certain way. It was, you know, if you live in Clapham, then you'd be asked on social media what you think about Clapham Common. And I thought that was incredible. It was a real eye-opener. But how do you see, moving forwards, how are you engaging with people more broadly, maybe even outside London, on the future of the built environment, about urban regeneration? Do you see that there's other thought leadership projects that Common Place can get behind that influence these things?
Yes, is the short answer. I mean, Park Power is a fantastic project. We really, really enjoyed being part of it. And I think, as you say, the opportunity that was created by thinking about providing this kind of engagement theme that wasn't related to any specific project. So it wasn't commissioned, if you like, by a developer or a local authority or another organisation who was, you know, developing or catalysing change. It was just trying to get a sense of what people in London thought about their green spaces. And then there was a whole fantastic set of activities and outputs that came from that. And by the way, I think that was a fantastic example of how the London Collective works really, really well together.
Yeah, it did click into place.
It did really click, yeah. It really, really did click. So, you know, in terms of going forward, there's a whole bunch of different themes and topics and so on that we would love to take a similar approach with. The one that we're thinking about quite hard at the moment is brownfield sites. And, you know, there are several thousand, I think there's actually about somewhere between 20 and 30,000 brownfield sites around the UK. So these are sites that have previously been used or developed in some way. And each of those sites is in a community of some sort. Some of them are more developed, you know, some of them have planning permission, some of them don't. But we're thinking about whether there is a way for Common Place to be deployed to allow people to talk about the brownfield sites that are close to them, on the basis that they as communities are going to have a lot of interest in what is developed and how it's developed on those sites going forward.
Well, that sounds brilliant. I mean, in many ways, we had a session with Natasha Reed earlier, who's an expert in social impact, as you know. And one of the things she was saying was that there isn't enough sort of data and understanding of people's sentiments about the built environment in the same way that there is readily available evidence when it comes to the environmental issues, the social issues. There isn't enough for people to really understand in a granular way about each street, each community, and what they think and what they want and their hopes and dreams, and how the built environment regeneration can help facilitate some of that. So I suppose what you're talking about is almost having a sort of national database that gives that sort of barometer of feeling about change in the built environment, which I imagine from an investor or developer point of view would be very helpful too, before they commit to millions of pounds on a planning application, sort of understanding the lie of the land, as it were. Is that something you're...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think that kind of packages up quite neatly what we try to do as an organisation. We try to bring together developers, local authorities, other kind of change makers with the community, and actually provide a bit of glue for them to have a collaboration that maybe without the sort of data that we can help collect is much more difficult.
Because you've already got a lot of people already kind of on...
A lot of people, a lot of data. So we've got close to 3 million data points around the UK. So we already have, mainly in large towns and cities, quite a good understanding in some places. So, in certain boroughs in London, we've got a really, really good understanding. Can actually look at how people from one ward to the next ward are thinking about green issues or about safety, for example. And we'd love to be able to extend our ability to do that more broadly. And I think, I mean, back to what you were talking about a little while ago, Commonplace isn't a democratic tool in any formal sense. We're not being commissioned to be part of any elections. But as part of a kind of broader conversation that I definitely see as part of the democratic process, I think it's really, really important and valuable. And I think it's a slightly different way of having those conversations, which I would love to see kind of developed and extended in the future.
Can you see a scenario where it's almost mandated, like to have something like a commonplace or that type of a social impact assessment? Because we have environmental impact assessments as statutory requirements in a planning application, but not social impact, and yet it's something that's talked about in the same way. Big discussions these days around ESG, but it's that S, isn't it, in ESG, which is often misunderstood or not properly kind of considered.
I mean a lot of what we do now we see as being part of that S of the ESG, and that means really helping extend the conversation from what is still the majority of our work, which is pre-planning consultation, but increasingly we're seeing commonplace being used beyond the planning kind of microcosm, if you can call it that, and being used for post-occupancy evaluation, for understanding behaviours around energy consumption, for a whole range of different things that when you put them all together is very much, I think, the S, the kind of social impact, social understanding of social value. And that I would love to be a kind of accelerating part of what we do going forward. Back to your question about whether that could become statutory, I think as part of the planning process, and I've been, whenever I'm asked, suggesting that there should be more teeth to what's included in the planning legislation about what is expected, what are the actual expectations in terms of engagement. And I think it would really help if the bar was set a bit higher for those. Whether you can mandate that more broadly outside of the planning process to have social impact assessments would be fascinating to think about.
It would, wouldn't it? Yeah, and good timing, I suppose, to be trying to influence politicians, different parties. You've got a general election and a mayoral election in London next year. So, you know, that this is a good time to be calling for more structural changes in terms of how we ask people to think about these things as a matter of course.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the politicians have to make the decisions on these things. And as you say, there's a window of opportunity is there. Currently thinking about their manifestos, and then as they get into their roles and start working out what they're actually going to do.
Okay, Mike, so this might now sound a bit like we're playing a party game, but it's a question that I often find is very revealing about people, that particularly who work in our industry. So if you were to choose between how you describe yourself, and the choice was between being an agitator, an activator, an ambassador, or a protector, or some combination of those things, what would you choose? How would you describe yourself?
So I'm definitely an activator at the kind of top of the pile. My personal kind of approach to management, for example, is very much hiring people, you know, trying to hire people who are smarter than me, and then trying to get out of the way for them to be able to perform. I like and enjoy seeing people develop and giving them new opportunities. It's one of the joys of running a company, is being able to do that. And commonplace is, you know, I see as an activation tool. It's something that gives people a platform, a way of speaking, of having influence that perhaps they didn't have before, and to the end of having a collaboration that can actually make a change. So both personally and in terms of what commonplace as a company does, I definitely see myself as an activator. In terms of being an agitator, I think in working in the areas that we do, some of which are quite controversial, some of the topics of consultation are quite controversial, we do become an agitator, not because we're trying to be.
Agents of agitation.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird, and sometimes I find it quite hard to understand. But sometimes we're kind of mistaken as the platform that's providing the opportunity to talk for the organisations who are actually trying to drive the change. So we quite frequently get accused of being biased, of pushing certain agendas, and we try really hard to be completely neutral and independent.
Well, it's that classic "don't shoot the messenger" type situation, isn't it? Because ultimately, you're carrying a conduit for channeling people's views, which, if you don't like it, then at least you know that this is what exists, and it's something you have to react to one way or the other. There's a worse scenario, which is not knowing in the first place, isn't it?
Indeed, indeed. And I think where we agitate a little bit over and above that, or in a slightly different way, is that there hasn't always been a way of having these conversations that's quite open. So one of the things that is slightly different about commonplace is that most of the conversations, not all of them, but most of the conversations on commonplace are quite open. And that's a bit of an agitation, I think, to the way that these processes have often been run. And it's, I think, very beneficial because it gets more people involved and it generates more trust. But it's definitely a slightly different way of looking at things.
It is, yeah. I often think that commonplace occupies this interesting territory, which is because there's other sort of software platforms, if you like, that are just that. They are a piece of software. You buy a license. You might speak to someone when you're buying the license, but you'll never speak to them again because you get trained on it and off you go. But I think commonplace for me is, and also this is interesting about the culture of the team that you built and the service that you provide, is it's a sort of ongoing relationship that is like a consultancy in many ways, because you're more often than not, the people that are using it need to be able to adapt to each situation, but also sort of feedback what they've learned and improve, you know, the product ultimately. But it's much more than just a product that's being sold, isn't it? It's that's why I often include you in teams that we put forward when we're bidding for things, is you're kind of part of the team rather than something that you buy off the shelf, as it were. Was that something that you always consciously set about to do, or something that surprised you about commonplace?
I think I describe it as a service. So it does have a product at the core of it, but the way it's used, the way it's consumed, is very much as a service. And that service includes, all the support and, as you say, the kind of bits of the service which are recommendations and suggestions and reviews and so on, to make sure that everybody who uses it is getting the best possible experience out of it. Was it something I planned? Not in the sense that I sat down and thought, well, it's going to have to work like that. But it has become, it quite quickly became evident that was the way that it would have to work in order for it to be successful. And so, the people who work for commonplace are passionate about the kind of projects, the kind of customers that we work with, the communities we work with, the kind of outcomes that we're striving to achieve.
Well, that was absolutely brilliant, Mike. Thank you so much. And I've learned a lot in the last sort of half an hour or so, even though we've known each other and worked so closely. That's something I find really interesting about doing these podcasts, is you do really sort of get under the skin. And it's brilliant to be working with you, Mike. And I look forward to carrying on working with you and doing even more interesting and exciting things in the future. And good luck to you and commonplace. And I know that it's something that you're at the very forefront of, and that's a nice position to be in, but it's also quite challenging and always not the easiest position to be in either, as a trailblazer. So, congratulations on what you do, and really looking forward to carrying on working with you in the future.
Thanks, Max. As I say, it's been a joy and a privilege to be part of the London Collective, and really looking forward to seeing what we can do next.